Okay, the deal with animals. I think this question is so difficult to answer.
Welcome to The Deal with Animals. I'm Marika Bell, answer zoologist, CPDT certified dog trainer, and an animal myself. This is a podcast about the connection and interaction between humans and other animals.
I love this question. What's the deal with animals?
What do I think is the deal with animals? I think the deal with animals, I think is off. They're awesome.
Well, I think the deal with animals is...
What is the deal with the animals? Oh gosh.
So the deal with the animals, you know? What the deal with animals is that
really the deal with animals for us.
So what do you think is the deal with animals?
Today, we're talking to researcher and lecturer at the University of Edinburgh, Maddie Wilkes, about how attitudes towards animals are formed in early childhood. Are certain children more prone to becoming vegans or vegetarians, or is it all in how they're raised? And would your child choose to save a human or a dog on a sinking ship? Find out in this episode and stay until the end to hear shoutouts and information about future episodes. Could you please introduce yourself and share your pronouns?
Hi, yeah, thank you very much for having me. My name's Maddie Wilkes. I'm a lecturer, or in America, that would be an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Edinburgh. And my pronouns are she, her.
Thank you very much. And today we are going to talk about how attitudes towards animals develop in children and young people. So what is your research primarily focused on there?
So really broadly, I'm a developmental psychologist by training, but I use both social and developmental methods to sort of address this question of what are the barriers to moral and pro-social behavior. And that's a super broad non-committal type research area. So narrowing that down, what I'm really looking at the moment is this concept of moral circle expansion, or who we do and don't think of as worthy of moral concern. And of course, animals are a really big part of that, as of one of the groups that we in many cases don't seem to grant moral status to. So the work I'm doing at the moment is trying to understand the factors that shape who we do and don't care about. And basically, there's sort of factors about the person or the entity that we're judging. So things like we tend to grant more moral status to beings that we think of as intelligent or beings that we think of as similar to us. But more recently, I've gotten interested in factors about ourselves that shape our moral circle as well. So how is it that who I am shapes who I care about? And in this work, I've been looking at how children and adults differ in their moral concern. So across a few different studies, I find that children are more likely to grant moral status to distant others than adults are. So this includes artificial entities, as well as physically and culturally distant people, but also animals. And so my collaborators and I find this using a few different methods that children from around 5 to about 10 years of age, which is about the extent of the age range we've tested, grant more moral status to these distant entities. And so now we're trying to do a little bit more work to explore what's really going on there. Why is that happening? Why are they giving these responses?
So what are the main questions that you're asking then specific to that?
So in these studies, the most recent study with animals, which is looking at how children and adults sort of trade off lives between humans and animals, we present the participants with studies where they're asked to sort of save, pick who they want to save from a sinking boat. And we tell them both of these boats are sinking and you can choose to save just one. Whichever boat you choose, everybody on that boat will be okay. We don't ever say everybody in the other boat won't be, but it's sort of implied there. And then we say, you know, would you choose to save the boat with one person or the boat with 10 dogs or a boat with two people versus one dog? And we give them all of these trade-offs. And what we found was that adults would generally choose to save one person over sort of any number of animals, whereas children would save, I think it worked out to be something like 6 pigs or 2 dogs over one person on average. And of course, you get a lot of variability in the responses there. But when you look at how that plays out sort of visually, you can see there's just a massive difference in the amount of moral status that children grant to animals versus humans as compared to adults.
So you're looking at where that comes from?
So this is very early stages. We're still kind of, you know, looking at whether this is a legitimate effect. You need to do a lot of research in psychology to be sure, but we've now, our group and a few other researchers have replicated this. So next steps are sort of trying to understand what's driving that, what we think could be causing this thing. And there's a lot of different candidates for it, but we don't have a definite answer for anyone yet, unfortunately.
So what are your, can you share any current kind of hypothesis or guesses that even 2 or 3 that you're going to be looking at?
Yeah, so I guess it's been particularly surprising. So I remember when we were setting up these experiments, we sort of thought, so my collaborator, Lucius Caviola, who's the co-lead on our recent paper, has done this work with adults in the past. And in line with what we find, adults have this very strong speciesist tendency, as we call it, which is this tendency to prioritize humans over animals simply because we're humans. And he's done a lot of really great work into that. When we set out to test this in children, we were kind of expecting that we'd need to have, you know, 1,000 animals or 10,000 animals for them to ever choose. We were really surprised that the numbers were so low. And when you look at sort of historically, when you look at moral development as a field, there's a kind of narrative that children start out quite sort of self-oriented and self-focused, and over time they become more egalitarian. So for example, children at 4 years of age know that they should share their resources equally with another child, but it's not until about 8 years old that they'll actually do it. And so there's always been this sort of dominant narrative in psychology that you learn to be moral or something like that. And that's starting to change, including this work that we have, which shows that, you know, younger children especially seem to be even more willing to grant moral status to others. So if our view is correct, or if our data is correct, then a couple of potential explanations would be, maybe it's that over time children learn that they shouldn't grant moral status to these different beings. So it could be a socially learned thing. It's just not what's done in your culture. But there's also a term which you might be familiar with called Vistopia, which is sort of like the dystopian feeling that vegans have because they're living in this non-vegan world and there's so much suffering going on. I don't think this is a official term in academia or anything. It's just a term that I've come across in my reading. And I think it really captures this idea that if you spend a lot of time thinking about all the suffering that of animals in the world, it is really quite confronting. And so it would probably be quite protective to you to not focus on this kind of suffering and to deny animals moral status. And there's evidence of this. So there's some fantastic work by like Steve Lochnan and Brock Bastian, who look at things like cognitive dissonance around meat consumption. And so in one of the really classic studies that they've done, they've shown that people who anticipate, if you bring people into a lab and ask them to rate the mental attributes of farmed animals and then tell them, okay, now you're going to try some food, people who think that they're going to be eating beef jerky will then rate the cow or sheep as having fewer mental attributes or lower mental attributes than somebody who thinks that they're going to eat apple. So we have evidence that adults really do engage in this cognitive dissonance as a way to sort of get away from meat consumption mentally. And so possibly there's something going on there with kids in a more abstract way where they're starting to learn, well, we really don't treat animals well in a lot of cases. So what is it like, why it's sort of motivating to choose not to grant them moral status anymore?
Yeah, so that's really interesting. It makes me wonder, in general, the background of those children too, and you know, their family backgrounds, and whether they're supported in that feeling of animals having more moral status than other children would be. But this idea of speciesism, can we go into that a little bit more? Because it feels to me, I've always had this issue with it in terms of why not be speciesist? You know, if we are human and, you know, we prioritize ourselves, we prioritize our family, we prioritize our tribes, and we prioritize our humanity over just about everything else, you know, in the short term, particularly, So why is that not okay? Or is it?
So, I mean, I'm a psychologist. I'm not an ethicist or a philosopher. I'm not here to tell you what you should and shouldn't think. I'm just reporting what we think people might think. So I'm not going to give you a strong answer on why you should or shouldn't be speciesist. But to me, personally, it feels like granting moral status differently to people just because we're people doesn't feel very justified. I think if we want to really reduce suffering, which I think is a goal that I support, best way, I guess, to reduce suffering is to be impartial about who you're reducing suffering for. If we think that all suffering is important and we want to maximize how much we can reduce suffering, then it shouldn't matter who it's for. It should be about helping the most people or the most animals. And so if we're capable of, you know, making small changes that would reduce suffering for animals, then that feels like something that would be good to do. And saying, oh, but they're not people, just doesn't really seem like a compelling argument to me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
And I mean, this is reflected in my other work as well, right? So I study why we might grant less moral status to physically distant others. So there's the drowning pond scenario with Peter Singer, which is, you know, if you see a child drowning in a pond, should you save that child? And everyone says, even though you'll ruin your new $50 shoes and be late for work. And everyone says, of course you should save the child. And then the question is, well, then why is it okay to lose $50 to help this child, but not a child who's dying of a preventable disease in a developing nation? And I really don't think that there's any difference between those children from a moral standing perspective.
That difference between whether a child shares versus whether a child feels like two dogs have more moral standing than one human or are more worthy of saving than one human. Why don't those two things mesh, do you think? Why are they happening at different times?
I'm really glad you asked that because that was sort of the other explanation. So we talked a little bit about that maybe it's protective to be denying animals moral status as you age. But I think another possible explanation here is just potentially when children are asked these really hypothetical principle dilemmas, they're thinking in a really abstract way about this dilemma. So most people would agree like with the statement, like we should grant moral status to all people, right? We should care about everyone and we should try to, you know, reduce suffering where we can. But not everybody would agree, I should give up my resources. I should concretely think about what I need to do to help this person. And sort of impartiality or impartial beneficence is a really big discussion in ethics and like how impartial should we be? And to be clear, I'm definitely not advocating that we should treat everybody like our family members or anything like that. It's just not a feasible position. It's more of a case of maybe we can treat distant others a little bit better than we do now rather than completely having no differences. So if you think about it like that, it could be that children are just not really thinking through the implications of these kind of big questions, saying, yes, we should grant moral status to this distant other, or we should sacrifice this boat with one person to save the boat with 10 dogs, but not really thinking about what that would mean in practice or what the implications are. And so that's kind of where I want to explore a little bit more. We've done a little bit in terms of checking that this isn't just a product of, you know, children being confused by the numbers. So if we have our one-to-one comparisons, children are choosing to save the dog about the same amount of time as they're choosing to save the person and about the same amount of time as they're saying they can't decide. So it's about a third, whereas adults are choosing to save the person over the dog. So we know that it's not just a matter that they're confused by the numbers. And we have some control questions in our studies too. So for example, we say, would you save one person or 10 plates? Some kids do save the 10 plates, and you have to think that's a pretty difficult moral position to defend. Maybe they don't actually understand the dilemma here. So in those scenarios, we analyze the data with and without those children, and we do get the same pattern. So we've gone a little way in checking, like, do children really understand this? And I think that they do, but we don't necessarily know at what level they're interpreting the questions.
Right. So if you then, after they've given their answer, asked them, have you thought about how this person's family would feel if you saved the 10 dogs instead of the person, now what would you choose?
Yeah. So,
and let them like sit and think about that versus the owners of the dogs.
Exactly. I think that's a really great question. Maybe we'll have to introduce something like that in our studies. One of the questions we have asked, so when we were initially talking to them, we would be like, when we were piloting the studies, we asked them, you know, why did you pick the plates? And we also had a one person versus 10 worms question. And we'd say, why did you pick the worms? Just to see what was going on. And, one girl turned around to me and said, well, I chose worms because humans hurt the earth and worms save the earth. And I thought, like, that's a coherent moral view. That's very justified.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
Wow. It's interesting, isn't it? Just where that all comes from. I mean, especially the idea of distant others, because that's one, again, that comes up so much in adult life. And knowing how that develops in children is, you know, I think really important to find out why adults seem to are more easily able to ignore when something is happening far away to people they don't know or people that look different than them. I mean, our most recent, obviously terrible example would be what's going on in Ukraine right now, where it's a really hard, you know, horrible thing that's happening. And over here in the West, we seem to care about it a lot, at least at the moment, because we do tend to have short memories for these sorts of things, unfortunately.
Yes.
But when a similarly terrible thing was going on in the Middle East, it's maybe doesn't seem to get as much traction over here in the West. And is that, I mean, distances are fairly similar. So it really, to me, would come down to then how those people look.
Yeah. So I think you're exactly right. And I've actually just, with my collaborator and I, have just finished looking at data with children and adults and basically manipulating whether someone's physically distant or culturally distant from you. So whether they live far away or whether they do things like eat the same food, listen to the same music and play the same games. And basically close, physically close or physically far, culturally close or culturally far. And then we ask about these dyads of people, how obliged are they to help one another if they needed help? And what we find is that adults kind of think you're not obliged to help anybody, regardless of whether they're close or far, but they do distinguish between, you know, closer and more distant people. Whereas so older children are kind of halfway. So this is children about 7 to 10 are sort of starting to say that you're not obliged to help and differentiating a little bit. Younger children say you often are obliged to help, not all the time, but, you know, more, I think more than 50% of the time they'll say you are obliged to help, but they don't tend to distinguish between these groups as much. We also ask them, though, who will help, and then they show that they expect people to help less if somebody's far away or culturally distant. So it's not like they don't understand these categories. It's just that they seem to think that you should be equally obliged to help someone, regardless of how far away they are or how different they are from you.
And so and in line with that, said the same?
Adults say you're not obliged to help anybody.
Really?
They had really low ratings of saying yes. And I think obliged is or obligated is quite a strong term. I wonder if we'd said how good is it for them to help each other, we would have had much higher response rates. But because we said, does this person have to help? We had very low yes rates.
Interesting.
But then they also are more likely to differentiate between culturally close and far people and physically close and far people.
So they would be more likely to help, again, if the person was distant but similarly cultured?
So we haven't split the data looking at it that way. We've basically just looked at, like, how does someone, they basically say you have to help somebody who's culturally similar to you more than someone who's culturally distant, and someone who's physically close to you more than somebody who's physically distant.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's exactly in line with what you've said about, like, it's not just a matter of physical distance. It's also about similarity.
I'm just surprised that adults would be super honest with that. It seems to me that as an adult, when you think about what you should do versus what you would do, those things tend to be different.
Yeah. I think the way we worded the question probably encouraged people to be a bit more honest, because saying, yes, these two people, and it wasn't about you, right? It was about two strangers, dyads that didn't know each other. Do they have to help each other if one of them needs help? And I think if you frame it like that, it's like, well, no, they don't technically have to help each other. No one has to do anything. So I'd love to rerun the study and also ask them, should they help each other? And I think they'd say yes in most cases.
Yeah, I think you're right. That difference between should and have to is a big difference when you're an adult.
And I think this is sort of reflective when we think about our obligations to help others in general. We think of charitable giving, we think of donations and all of this stuff as sort of supererogatory. It's not something we're obliged to do. It's going over and above. And that this is one of the factors in some of my other work that I look at, which is, you know, what is it about these sort of people who are particularly altruistic, particularly willing to go out of their way to help others that aren't similar to them or aren't close to them? And what's unique about these people? So much of psychology and research in psychology is looking at these sort of group level effects. How can we try and get the general population to be pro-social, to be ethical? And I'm sort of saying, we're not having a lot of luck there. Maybe we should be looking at the people that are already doing this and see what's different about them as a way to try and uncover why it is that some people are so motivated to help others and most of us really aren't.
And that's primarily children.
Children is one thing. So we seem to find that children, at least in terms of what they say they think we should be doing, are very altruistic. But I've also got some work with people who've taken the Giving What We Can pledge, which is a pledge to donate at least 10% of your income to effective charity across your lifespan. And also relevant to the podcast is children who are vegetarian and meat-eating families. So what is it about these young kids who sort of hear about what happens to animals in meat production and then suddenly go like, well, I'm not going to eat meat anymore, even though it's a social norm, even though it's what their families do. You know, young kids can't donate their kidneys to strangers, which is a great example of an altruistic act. They can't donate much of their income to charity because they generally don't have income, but they can choose not to eat meat. And I've always been really fascinated by this sort of group of kids that sort of learn about what happens to animals and then go, nope, I'm not eating anymore, even though all kids learn at some point. So like, why is it that some children are so motivated that way? And there's been some research prior to mine which shows that these kids tend to be more morally motivated. So it does seem to be a moral decision where they think like, this isn't the ethical thing to do, but we really don't know that much about them yet.
Yeah, because it could be personality, just natural inborn personality, or it could be, you know, early learning. And again, what kind of even if their parents don't eat or aren't vegan or vegetarian, maybe their parents still very much support moral choices towards, you know, being compassionate.
Exactly. And so this is something I'm trying to look into. We've tested a bunch of different personality or kind of cognitive traits that we're thinking might differentiate them. And we haven't finished data collection with the kids yet, but we've tested a retrospective adult sample of adults. So people who say that they became vegetarian when they were kids. Mm-hmm. And we find for them, they're higher in empathy and they're lower in social dominance orientation, which is sort of support of a hierarchical worldview. So how much you agree with statements like for society to function, some groups need to be on the top and others should be on the bottom. And they're also unsurprisingly lower in speciesism, but we don't know what this will look like for kids yet.
Right. Does that happen before or after they've chosen to be vegan or vegetarian?
Exactly. Yeah. So I think it will be really fun when we do finally get to see the results. But I think you're right as well about the level of compassion and also things like how contrarian or autonomous this child is, how much are they encouraged to sort of give free thought. I also wonder if there's a genetic component. You know, is there something heritable about being vegetarian or vegan? Unfortunately, the issues with studies like this is that you need massive samples to be able to do these studies, like twin studies. And often when you look at, for example, parenting studies, you don't know if like, let's say you have a parent who is an anxious parent, and then research can say, oh, well, anxious parenting styles lead to anxious children, but possibly parents with anxious genes are going to end up with children with anxious genes. And so it's so hard to tease apart these kinds of mechanisms when you're looking at like the role of parents in shaping who we are.
Yeah, that is interesting. Because I know with dogs, that has been found. If you have a really anxious female and her offspring tend to be anxious whether she raised them or not. So if they were taken away at a really early age and she didn't raise them, they still tend to be a lot more anxious than those puppies that had a super confident, relaxed mom. And it was more heritable for the mom than it was for the dad as well. So the dad's anxiety didn't actually affect the puppies as much. This research was conducted at the University of Helsinki. The summary says researchers have identified a new genomic region and anxiety-related candidate genes associated with fearfulness in dogs. Findings support the hypothesis that fearfulness and anxiety are hereditary traits in dogs, and there may be shared factors underlying anxiety in both humans and dogs. You can get the link to the article at Science Daily. I'll link it in the show notes, and I'll also share it on Twitter and on the Facebook page.
That's really interesting. So, I mean, typically they don't let you take children away from their parents and raise them to see what happens. Yeah, not something we're allowed to do, but there are twin studies to look at it. But it's, yeah, very interesting to know, especially that it's more the mother than the father.
Yeah. I guess you'd have to find people who are going to adopt out their children anyway, maybe.
Yeah, so they do twin studies, and I don't know much about the methods because it's not my field, but they sort of look at twins that were raised in different environments and look at which traits they share versus which traits that they don't. But I don't know enough about the field to know if there's a bunch of work on vegetarianism, but I suspect that I would probably have come across it by now, given my focus. Who knows?
It would certainly be interesting. And I mean, other practical applications to this. If the ultimate goal for you is to reduce suffering, what is it for others that are doing this work, do you think?
Meaning what's the point of this kind of research?
What's the point?
Yeah, so I think for a lot of people, they're genuinely just interested. I think a lot of people end up doing research. So I have to admit, I was raised in a vegetarian household. So probably some of my interest in vegetarianism has come from the way that I was raised. But a lot of people out there, I think, are just really interested. But I think ultimately, if we can for me at least, and I think this is true for some of my collaborators and colleagues, if we can understand the factors that, you know, shape who we do and don't care about, then there might be ways to intervene or things that we could do to try and encourage us to be more compassionate to not just animals, but all these different entities that are going to be on the outside of your moral circle. So people that are really far away, animals, potentially, you know, depending on how far you want to go down that evolutionary trait, like what about bugs? There's a whole lot of discussion of like eating bugs in lieu of eating meat, and you know, what are the ethical implications there? So while we don't know much about their suffering and their capacities to suffer, there is some potential for a lot of suffering to happen if it's true that they're sentient and capable of suffering and we decide to start farming them on scale. And so I think being able to understand the factors that shape how we think about the moral worth of others can hopefully allow us to over time try and work towards increasing the welfare of these distant beings. But it's a very, very slow and long road.
The research that I've done on sheep friendships and some of the ways in which we can use information to help humans feel compassion or at least demonstrate compassion towards distant others, other animals, is through practicing compassion or practicing the idea of what I feel is similar to what someone else feels, whether that someone else is a sheep or another human who lives a distance away, and how that, you know, affects those behaviors.
As an aside, if you're also interested in hearing about my work in sheep friendships, I first presented the research at the International Society for Anthrozoology Conference in Barcelona 2016, and then again more recently at the Symbiotic Ethics Conference 2021, organized by the Exeter Anthrozoology as Symbiotic Ethics Working Group. I'll also be speaking about it more as a guest on upcoming podcasts, which I will link on the Deal with Animals website when they become available.
I think that's, yes, first of all, I thought your research was very cool and interesting. I listened to you talk about it and I thought it's a really cool project. So in terms of compassion, I have a lot of different views here. There's a kind of a lot to unpack. So for part of it, my old PhD supervisor, James Kirby, actually has just published a study showing that compassionate mind training, so like mindfulness with compassion, can expand the moral circle, which is huge, right? There's been hardly any research showing tangible ways to actually expand the moral circle. So I think in the abstract, there's some potential there. The other side of that, and what it sounds like you're talking about a little bit more, is compassion for specific beings, the capacity to sort of empathize with them and connect to them. Mm-hmm. Does that sound right? Yeah. So I think that's really powerful. And there's research, so a study showed that the more sort of evolutionarily similar we see beings as being to us, the more empathy we have towards them. So there's a lot of evidence already that creatures or beings that we see as more like us, we grant more moral status to. It's the same with robots. If we see robots as more human-like, we grant them more moral status until you get to that uncanny valley area where we're terrified of them. But in general, more like us, more able to empathize, more compassion, and presumably better treatment. The kind of, I guess, other side of this, so I did my postdoc with Paul Bloom, Professor Paul Bloom from Yale, and he's at the University of Toronto now, sorry, and he wrote famously the book Against Empathy, which is basically a book arguing that empathy isn't a really good way to make moral decisions because it's easier for us to empathize with people who are similar to us and it's easier for us to sort of feel compassion and connected to them. And so in some ways, I think compassion and empathy and all these things are absolutely necessary because it allows us to feel the things that we need to feel. But on the other hand, there are costs to that. So a really famous example of this is something called the identifiable victim effect. There's been a number of studies that have shown this with adults. And only last month, I just found one that has also tested this in kids, which I was pretty excited about. It's something that's been on my like bucket list of studies to run for a long time. So I'm excited that someone else has done it. Basically, they find that if you ask people to donate money to either sort of an identified victim, so somebody where you know their name, you know their story, you have a picture of them, the kind of advertising that places like World Vision do, people will donate more to help that one child than, or are more willing to donate money to help that one child than they would be to try and donate the same amount of money to a group, for example, of eight children. So even though the money would go further in the scenario where you don't know who the victims are, you're going to be more likely to donate money to this identified child because you feel connected to them. And I think that's a pretty good example of a case where we just using our feelings isn't always going to lead us to necessarily the most effective or the most moral thing that we could be doing in one case. Though, of course, depending on what you think the most moral thing is.
Right. Yeah, because I suppose in my research, my thought process was it was almost using empathy like a muscle. You know, the more you practice it, the better you get at it for everybody, is what I would hope. And it would be nice to see if that is actually true or not. But
yeah, I think it has to be done. Like, we can't make moral progress without it, but I think it has to be done alongside this kind of more impartial assessment and thinking, really, like, what can we do to actually help the greatest number of people and or animals?
Yeah, absolutely. So are there any other sorts of studies that you're hoping to build off from this?
Yeah, so we have a few studies building off our speciesism work. So Lucius and I are kind of now looking at sort of contextual factors that shape these moral judgments. So one of the big questions that we always get asked when we talk about the speciesism data is, you know, well, but which child, or like, sorry, which person, which dog, like, who are we actually talking about here? And so now we're running a study where we're comparing family members and strangers. So would you save, you know, your family dog or two people, and trade-offs like that, to see how social relationships come into it. We are still only collecting the data now, so I don't think anything to report yet. And we have another study underway where we're looking at how intelligence factors in here. So past work has shown that intelligence does seem to shape moral judgments. So we seem to grant more moral status to beings that we think of as more intelligent. I think that intelligence is a really vague concept a lot of the time when we're measuring this. You sort of say, how smart do you think this entity is? But what does smart mean? What kinds of intelligence are relevant is still a really open question. So I think that's an area that I'm not working on, but really needs to be worked on. But Lucius and I are looking at how, basically, if you manipulate intelligence, so you have a really smart animal or a less smart person, and how that shapes our judgments as well. So if we bring an animal up to being as intelligent as a person, does that then mean that they're granted similar moral status? And the idea behind this is trying to figure out, when children are granting more moral status, or particularly when adults are denying moral status, is it simply on the grounds that humans are humans and animals are animals, or is it something like, we think humans are more intelligent, so they're more worthy of moral concern? And so trying to partial out what the role of intelligence is in there as well. We're also trying to replicate this because there's a big problem in psychology, especially developmental psychology, in that all of our samples come from the United States or the United Kingdom. So all of our research is these kind of white Western countries. And so right now we know that there's a group in China who's looking to replicate our work. We've been working with a group to replicate it in Poland. So we're really hoping to try and look at how this varies across culture. And I think looking at it cross-culturally will also help us to kind of understand the social learning mechanisms. So if we can see that, you know, potentially societies that have much higher rates of meat consumption or worse treatment of animals, or, you know, the norms are different in adults, and then we see that children are also more speciesist or less likely to grant moral status to animals in those countries, then that will start to tell us whether this is something that is socially learned and something that children are picking up from people around them.
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting. Because that is something that falls down a lot, isn't it, with Western research, is that we tend to focus on Western thought processes and cultures.
Yeah, and there's just so many things that I think we take for granted as being generalized to the whole world without actually having tested this in a whole range of different cultures. And especially when you think about, you know, the United States and the United Kingdom and the political systems, it's like, how confident do we want to be that these ideas are going to generalize to people all over the world and make these universal claims about human psychology? It's a very big problem.
And even culturally different with children, just in the US, for instance, you know, if you're coming from Black families, Indigenous families, immigrants, or people who've been here for generations, what does that change, if anything?
Yeah, and also things like urban families versus rural families, there's so many different factors. And unfortunately, we have this big sampling bias issue where the vast majority of the time, the majority of our participants are white, sort of middle-class families that bring their children into the lab to participate in research. And so groups are, I know developmental psychologists around the world are trying really hard to fix this, but there is still this really inherent bias in all of our data that I think needs to be worked on as well. I talk a lot about moral concern and moral status, and I jump around all these terms, but like, as a field, we've done a really bad job of defining what that even means. And I think that the way we think about moral status and what moral concern means will vary based on the entity that we're thinking about. So an example of this, I guess, is if you look at research into the moral circle, we have, for example, villains. So people who've done bad things with adults. This is like white supremacists, for example, tend to be an example used. And with children, we say things like a robber or a bully, like someone who hurts other people. They're granted no moral status. In many cases, they're granted less moral status than plants and objects. But we also have objects and plants and, you know, insects and stuff being put on the outside of the moral circle. But I think that they're there for very different reasons. The plant or the chair is there because it's sort of morally irrelevant. It doesn't have any moral status. So we can think of it as amoral, whereas the white supremacist or the bully, they're there because they've done something wrong. And so we think of them as immoral. And the way we're conceptualizing a moral concern right now doesn't really differentiate these kinds of things. And I think this is also going to be relevant to animals when we think about, you know, our moral obligations to something like our family pet feel very different than our moral obligations to something like a chimpanzee or another kind of megafauna type animal, which we think of as really beautiful and important for the ecosystem. But until we can really pull apart what that moral concern is systematically, we aren't talking about this, I think, in a nuanced enough way.
Is there a way, do you think, that teachers can take this information or could take this information when it's fully researched and use it in classrooms?
Yeah, so I've been asked about this before, and I don't have a lot of concrete answers for what I think teachers could be teaching their students. I guess it's what you want the goal to be. I mean, one of the things that came out of this work, so once the paper was published, somebody went and put it on Reddit, and I was reading the Reddit comments just to see what people thought, and people were really opinionated. Like, no one doesn't have an opinion about this. The other topic I study outside of this is attitudes towards cultured meat, and it's the same thing. Everybody has an opinion about cultured meat. No one really feels neutral, so it's always fun to see what people think. And it feels very like it's challenging a norm. So I think there's kind of been this belief that, you know, we are more important than animals, and because we, part of the justification for that has always been that we inherently, or we have some kind of innate or really early emerging bias towards people. And my work is starting to show that that might not be the case. And there's collaborators of mine. So for example, Julia Marshall has some great work showing, using similar methods, that children think that we're equally obliged to help a stranger versus a friend or a family member, whereas older children and adults think, of course, that we're less obliged to help strangers than friends or family members. And so there's this sort of been this assumption of partiality as this kind of inherent part of our core. And this work, depending on where it goes, might be starting to challenge that. And so I don't know if that's something that people would want in schools. It feels a little bit controversial to me, but I think it would at least go some way in sort of exploring social norms and challenging beliefs that families have. So I think in some ways it could be more informative for parents and families than it would be for young children. So really what we should be doing is having these education programs for parents rather than kids, right? Like training the parents. Like anecdotally talking to a lot of parents when I run their kids in these studies, they're always a bit like, oh, like this is quite surprising that they've chosen the dog over the people. And I say, well, actually a lot of kids do that. And I think with the animals, it can be a bit confronting because of this sort of, you know, this notion that we are more important. But when we look at like distant others and stuff, in some ways, I think parents are sometimes a bit pleased to see that their kid is compassionate and is trying to help as much as possible. And so it definitely seems like, at least in the abstract, it's something that we endorse. So yeah, I think that would be really lovely. Yeah. And I mean, for me, it brings up the question of like, right now there's no research, and this is something that we want to follow up with as well, looking at sort of kids between about 10, 12 and 18. And it feels like if we look at the data, young kids seem to be granting a lot of moral status, whereas older adults are not. So something is happening between 10 and 18. And so if we can sort of track what happens through that developmental period, then we might be able to get a more concrete idea of what actually does change. And if we can learn about what does change, then we have some capacity, if we think it's the right thing to do, to try and intervene there potentially.
Yeah. I mean, my initial thought is that that's, you know, when we start learning more about the outside world is during that time, and being introduced to the suffering that happens everywhere. Right. And then having to start weighing, you know, which suffering is the suffering that we are going to pay more attention to, because we all have a certain bandwidth, you know, and we can't, you know, this dystopian version, you'd get really anxious and upset if you felt like you were responsible for having to deal with all of the suffering. And I can see how at that point we would need to start deciding, you know, again, for self-protection, what is the suffering that we're going to have to care most about?
Right. So, I mean, I'm not sure that all my collaborators agree with me about this idea, but I think it sounds like I've somewhat convinced you. Like, that feels to me very much like something that we would want to protect ourselves from. And so, yeah, if that's the period of time where you're learning about all of this, then it makes sense that that would be the period of time where your moral circle contracts.
Let me ask you, if there was a book that you could share with all of the listeners, what would that be?
So I find it always very hard to recommend just one book because there's so many fantastic books in the space. But I think the book, if I go with the thing that has had the most impact on me, is probably The Most Good You Could Do by Peter Singer. So it's his 2015 book, and it was where I got introduced to the ideas of effective altruism and the idea of, you know, if we want to help, shouldn't we try to help as effectively as possible so we can help as many people and animals as possible, regardless of who they are? And that book really had a huge impact on the way I think about our obligations to others and sort of where I want to direct my time and energy. So The Most Good You Can Do.
Would you share a formative, early, maybe first memory of your connection with another animal?
Yeah, so I grew up in a house full of animals. So I think there's like 1,000 different memories that I could share. So I guess more broadly, like I grew up with a lot of rescue dogs. So we always had at least 2, sometimes up to 5 dogs living with us. And we had, my mum was a wildlife carer for injured birds. So at one point, I think we had 40 birds in a big, huge aviary thing in our lounge room, a big cage thing, so that we could raise and rehabilitate them and release them. And I also grew up in far north Queensland, Australia, which is like right near the Great Barrier Reef. It's the cassowary coast, where one of the only places in the world that the cassowary lives. So I've basically spent my whole life completely surrounded by animals. And I don't think that there's sort of one formative memory that sticks out for me.
If you've never seen a cassowary before, I highly recommend looking them up. They're probably the closest thing to a real live dinosaur you've ever seen. They can also be extremely dangerous. They are perfectly willing to attack and disembowel a human with their dagger-like talons if they feel threatened or are protecting their young. And they have beautiful blue noggins.
As I mentioned before, I was also raised by vegetarian parents who were pretty upfront with me that the reason they were vegetarian was because of animal suffering. So basically, from as long as I can remember, I've been aware of animals as like people, as entities, sorry, that we interact with in our lives and that we kind of have some form of moral obligation towards. So is it okay if I say there's too many?
Yeah, probably. Is there one that was maybe for you a connection, like you felt a connection to that animal in particular? Or was there too many around for you to even feel a connection with?
No, I remember, I mean, this is kind of a sad one. I don't know if I should say this on a podcast, but I remember when my mom and dad each had a dog that we'd rescued, and we found this dog that was, we had sort of spoken to the owners and said, look, if you ever don't want the dog, please come and, you know, let us know because we'll happily take him. And they said no. And then a while later, they kind of called us up and said, oh, if you don't come and get him, we're going to kill him because he's just bitten our new kitten. So we went and got him, and he was going to be my dog. And I was really excited. And I remember being like, yes, this is going to be my dog. And I had him on a lead, and I was walking him all around. And he didn't really want to hang out with me. He wanted to hang out with my mom because she was the one that fed him and she was the one that did all of this stuff for him. And that was, I remember, it was kind of more a lack of connection where I was loving this animal so much. And I realized that it's not just about me. It's also about their needs and their wants. And I think that was kind of a formative moment for me, at least in how I think about connections to animals, that it needs to be reciprocal. You can't just impose your own needs on them.
Yeah, that's actually something I'm trying to teach my 5-year-old all the time, because she definitely wants to. She is the instigator for most of those relationships, but yet she's so pleased when, you know, the cat wants to play with her, when the cat, you know, is excited to play, you know, the chase game and chase the wand around. It makes her so happy. And yet she doesn't quite seem to get yet when she needs to leave that animal alone because the animal is saying no. And she is reading their body language better now. You know, if I say, what is the cat saying to you right now? She says, he's saying he doesn't want to play right now, but I want to play right now, so I'm going to keep playing. It's like, okay, well.
Yes, it's we'll get there. It's a difficult lesson to learn. I think a lot of adults even struggle with that, right? So,
oh, absolutely.
The fact that
she's
trying at 5 is amazing.
I'm a dog person. Here, let me pet your dog who doesn't want to be anywhere near me.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. I mean, that's a whole other discussion that I won't drag you through all my opinions on that. But yeah, it's very difficult to watch the number of people out there that are clearly thinking about themselves and how they relate to the animal rather than it as being mutually beneficial or reciprocal.
Yeah. So what is the deal with animals?
Okay, the deal with animals, I think this question is so difficult to answer. And ultimately, I think that there's so many different animals and we have so many different relationships with them and interactions with them, or, you know, non-relationships with them, that there isn't just one deal. There's too many of them to be able to say, yes, this is the deal with animals. And so I guess there's too many, there's so many, and we're kind of so lucky to have such a diverse array of animals out there in the world, but I don't think I can give one deal that just does them justice. So I just kind of wanted to finish by saying I feel really lucky and really grateful for all of the exposures that I've had to them in my life and the interactions and things that I've learned from them. So not one deal, I'm sorry.
That's okay. The deal is that there's many deals.
I think that's
probably
right.
Very accurate.
Thank you. I hope so.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. And I hope to find out in the future where your research goes. Please keep me updated and send me links.
Thank you. I will happily do that. And thank you so much for having me. It's been really great to get to chat with you.
That was Maddie Wilkes, lecturer at the Department of Psychology at the University of Edinburgh. At the moment, her research focuses on the factors that shape our moral circles and why some people are so motivated to help distant others. Read more about Maddie at thedealwithanimals.com. There are also links in the show notes. I hope you enjoyed this first episode in Series 5, Children and Other Animals. Next week, we're going to school. We'll be talking to Mike Farley, a teacher of middle and high school geography and environmental studies for the last 20 years in Toronto. Mike founded and continues to organize the annual Educators for Animals Conference that brings together hundreds of educators from around the world who are interested in incorporating animal protection into their school communities. This is bound to be a thought-provoking episode. Shoutouts this week go to our new listeners in the Czech Republic and Romania. Thank you for listening in, and let me know what you think is the deal with animals. If you enjoyed this show and have any questions or comments about this episode or about the podcast in general, go to thedealwithanimals.com. Leave me a message. I will always read them. This is also a great place to go if you're interested in being a guest or have an idea for a series or episode. And don't forget to follow and review wherever you listen to your podcast, as it helps us become more visible to other listeners. The Deal with Animals was produced by me, your host, Marika S. Bell, and theme music was composed by Kai Stranskoff. Until next time, what do you think is the deal with animals? The Deal with Animals is part of the iROAR Animal Podcast Network. What do you think is the deal with animals?